Good evening, ladies and gentlemen.
Jason, today we're doing an interview with one of the people that played with us on our Don't Rest Your Head episodes, Charles Gray.
Right? Charles White. Charles Gray is just the name I use on Facebook.
Oh, fuck you. I'll keep that in there, whatever. So, I guess we get started then.
Yeah.
So,
sure.
Alright. I'm in his house, by the way. And it's St. John's. So, Newfoundland, for the listeners that are listening on YouTube. So, how long have you been a role player?
That is a difficult question. How long have I been a person who regularly role plays, or how long has it been since the first time I role played? Or other identity politics. The first time I role-played would have been when I was about 11, and my uncle introduced me and my older brother to D&D. So he just wanted to show us that D&D existed and it was awesome, so he just made up something on the spot, and we were a thief and a rogue and a warrior in some kind of orcish cavern. That session never finished, but we had the taste of it. And we started looking for, you know, D&D-related material. So I have a monster manual and DM's guide and the player's guide. But we never used it. We never had enough people.
It's only when I was about 15, 16, we actually found any friends whatsoever that would want to play D&D.
It's about the age they start, really.
Yeah, yeah. And then I had a different schedule than my brother, who was the DM, so that never happened. Flash forward 2 years later, my second year in university, 17. And that's when I actually began role-playing, all the time with my friends here at the Monday Hilltop Games Club that I started. So, I cut my teeth on D&D, but then the second and third RPGs I played were Seven Skies, Swashbucklers of the Seven Skies, and Star Wars Saga. Didn't like the system of Star Wars Saga, but they never stopped us, we just didn't use it. Since that time, I've been playing every week, every 2 weeks. There's rarely been a pause in between that, so...
Okay, alright. So D&D was basically the start of it all. I mean, that's generally the start of everybody's experience back in the...
It totally was. And, you know, we...
90s and early 2000s stuff, that's when you started, right?
When I say Dungeons and Dragons, well, stuff I also mean, like, computer RPGs and... Some board games that were related to it.
Like Baldur's Gate.
Oh, Baldur's Gate was amazing.
Yeah.
But I did not know that was D&D until after I played the first one as 10.
Really?
I had no idea it was connected to D&D.
Oh, wow.
We were kind of aware of what D&D was. Oh, Birthright. You ever played Birthright?
Yes, actually.
It's fucking amazing.
Birthright, that's... Yeah, you basically take control of a empire, and you go on little quests
to get
items.
Items of power, yeah. And you're trying to stop the Gorgon from going over Aang Wei.
There's actually a role-playing game based on that.
I know. I know it's the role-playing
Seven
game.
Edition.
Yeah. The game is based on the setting.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So after that, I mean, after your games with Seven Skies and whatnot, and the Star Wars, is that, like, did you play any other games after that?
Oh, a lot of them.
Okay,
Seven Skies went on for 2 years before the campaign finished.
Yep.
We were just supposed to go into the first experimental steamship, which looked like a metal tortoise, and everyone thought it would sink, and visit the seven major isles, seven sessions. Except, some of those turned into 3-session things, some of them turned into 5-session things. By the time we got to the final aisle, we had the 7 sessions on the final aisle.
Oh, nice.
And so, we ended up playing for 2 years, but every second week.
Yeah.
Star Wars Saga didn't last that long, simply because the DM didn't like where it was going, so then he introduced us to Mutants and Masterminds.
Okay.
We played that every second week for a while, until we just kind of broke the system by accident too many times.
Mm.
Really, really clear that the maker wanted it to be more and more narrative game, especially when he went off and made Icons.
So, I mean, like, game development, was that ever, like, one of your things that you ever thought about?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
not only in terms of RPGs, but board games, too. Have I shown you Metropolis yet?
No. So what is your favorite role-playing game thus far?
Well, I'm very biased towards Seven Skies, because we played it for such a long time, and we had a good DM, and the people who stayed in it, our characters really developed, and we had a great time playing with each other. In my own character, Carpoon Ladosi, went from, you know, just an ex-slave who was running away from his master, to, he eventually became a time-traveling steampunk god of clockwork, who murdered his master by dropping a castle on him, and then exploding time itself. And this is completely in character.
Wow.
If I had to say my favorite besides Seven Skies, you know, one that I've played on multiple systems, that's a harder question I thought. It might actually be Mutants and Masterminds, presuming that everyone plays it right.
Yeah.
Because we had a great time on that, and we did play, like, we had a rotating VM. And we always had fun, and we always had interesting things happen. And when you make a character and he's balanced with the other characters in the party, it can be pretty amazing. You do some pretty awesome stuff.
Well, we'll see. We'll ask you that question again after like a year of playing different systems and see if there's a system that might tweak you better.
Yeah, there's a lot of systems I've played. Like, Mouse Guard and Burning Wheel and Call of Cthulhu. And what's the one that's like Call of Cthulhu, but modern era? Delta Red? Delta Green? Okay, I played that with a guy called Chris who used to write modules for Grey Wolf. And he was an excellent DM. But the game itself, the setting itself, was amazing. You're basically people who have been secretly recruited by a secret agency to ward off Cthulhu and the other elder gods. Except that your handlers are always fucking assholes. And, you have a safe storage location in the city, but people always store unsafe things in there. So one of my characters was a pyromaniac who kept pipe bombs in there. And when he died on the first session, as tends to happen in the Cthulhu universe, all of a sudden there was a huge stack of pipe bombs sitting in the warehouse. So when someone else's character left a gas lamp in there, haunted a gas lamp as it happened, the whole thing went boom. And then the police had to investigate, and they found tomes that drove them crazy. Oh, it was absolutely great. I played a lot of systems. None of them are jumping to mind as being the best one.
That's good. Is there any RPG or supplement that you're looking forward to the seated release of, or one you want to see the release of?
The Far West. There's actually two by the name of The Far West currently, and they're both steampunk. The one that I'm interested in is one that my friend Sean brought to my attention when it was on Kickstarter a while back. It's basically a blending of, samurais and foxglove ladies and the Wild Wild West.
Hmm? What's it called?
The Far West.
It's The Far West, okay.
Yeah. And for the current moment, it's been delayed. It's already supposed to have been released in July because the main artist they had working for them suddenly had to quit due to personal reasons. And now, there's this different Far West coming out, and they're kind of like, well, what should we do in relation to this? But there are beta testers who have seen all the chapters written, and they're like, yeah, it's just rough work at this point, but the system's amazing. And, looking at the different possibilities of the character or classes that they want to add, it looks very inviting. Like, I'm not normally drawn in by class systems these days, since they tend to limit you a lot, but if they play into the setting is a huge part of the system, I think it can be great. And, the best setting that I like is Shadowrun, but I dislike its system. The system, I think, is kind of too wishy-washy.
Yeah, I played the second edition.
Second edition? Okay, I played second, third, and fourth, and I've always loved the setting. The Shadowrun games for the SNES and the Genesis were amazing, and I am a Kickstarter pledge for Shadowrun Returns.
Okay.
But Shadowrun does have a class system, but mostly it's it has a class-like system where you can't be a magician and a cybernetic dude unless you want to take massive penalties. So at the beginning, you make some choices about who your character is going to be, but then it's free as to how you advance. It's better if you advance as a shaman rather than as a shaman who gets cybernetic arms, Like I said, the system's too wishy-washy. It's too easy for a DM to say, well, that fits under that instead of this, and you'll get this much damage instead of that much damage.
Far West is the one that you actually wanted to see.
Yeah, Far West is one that I really want to see. I want to DM that, and I want to try my hand at that kind of story. I have yet to read the setting, but I have a lot of ideas of what I'm going to do.
Cool. Would you rather DM or be a player, or both?
Both. There's times when I love DMing, There's times when I would just rather sit back and play. But when I'm DMing, I go all in. I don't currently have them in my room at the moment, because I took them down to actually play a campaign with them. But I used to draw maps of all kinds. And they look very pretty.
But I have this campaign that I have now run 2.5 times for D&D,
which is a type of goblins slightly break the fourth wall thing. And, you know, I have maps for the area, I have maps for every single dungeon, I have maps for every rock that you can crawl under. And I love making these maps, and they're very detailed, and I used to have them up on the room, the wall of my room. Then I decided to try D&D again with a few friends of mine, you know, who wanted to RPG and were relatively new and wanted to try a system they were familiar with from games. So, in that session, the story is that you are goblins who decide to become adventurers so that you can gain experience levels and ward off all the newbies who come to raid your village.
Didn't they make a comic for that?
The webcomic Goblins?
Yeah.
That's what I based the beginning off of.
Okay.
Then we diverged wildly.
Was it called Goblins?
It was called Goblins. My campaign, I give the players kind of free reign. I have 3 different adventures that are suitable for whatever level they are, and they gain a level at the end of every session. When they're level 7, something forces their hand and they have to come to the final conflict. And that might be that the Lich King, who resurrected in the body of a goblin, and has been, you know, going after you this entire time because you picked up his phylactery, not knowing what it was, but knowing it was a powerful magical object, finally finds a body that's not a fucking goblin and comes after you. It might be that the humans on the east coast of the, this only starting to be civilized continent, bring mages from the mainland to conquer all the goblins and monsters. There's a lot of things that they could have done, a lot of other things that they could have built up. If they took the right quest each time, they could gather the 7 orbs of power, each of which represented a magical school, except for illusion, because the necromancer was originally an illusionist who couldn't carry on his work far enough. So once they gathered the 7 orbs, they could have done something fucking amazing, kind of thing. So the first 2 times I played it, the first time the humans invaded, and the goblins lost the final battle. Which was epic, and the group loved it, and that's the first time I've had a TPK that people liked. But, I had it all planned out, I had dialogues planned out, I had this planned out. So in that regard, I like to DM. But now that I've, kind of narrative RPGs, there's so much more fun for everyone going through, rather than just seeing the epic conclusion of the story that I've pre-written. And I have no idea how to do those. And I really want to. And it's another thing to have a narrative RPG which progresses at its own pace, the character's pace, and they build it as much as you do, you know? Of course you know. So yeah, my answer is that I love DMing,
yep.
But I always go overboard in planning. Even if it's a narrative RPG, I'll create like a diamond structure. Like, these are the possible choices they might make at each stage. Here's the important things I should pre-plan, because it'll be hard to.
So the next question is, how do you feel about metagaming, open and closed secrets during gameplay? An example is, do you believe the GM screened to hide his roles?
Not really. If you're metagaming, if you're having a good RPG, you're not playing a board game that just happens to use pen and paper. You're actually role-playing the character that you're in, so it shouldn't matter. That being said, in some of the more gamey games, D&D, Shadowrun, Eclipse Phase, dice matters a lot, and then metagaming matters a lot, especially in Eclipse Phase. I don't know if you're familiar with that. Future game, nanobots are extraordinarily useful. Humans no longer reproduce because they're effectively immortal. You can die and then have your body cloned and your brain cloned and your memories cloned, but only from the last time you made a backup. So there's actually an entire part of the character sheet that's for metagaming. Like, what does your last backup remember? The system's absolutely horrible because you're always metagaming all the time, not only because you might normally metagame a bit, but as part of the system. And a large part of the system is a gamey type system, which doesn't like metagaming at all. On the other hand, you enter a narrative RPG, you enter something like Fiasco, which I kind of lump into the narrative RPG. But in Fiasco, metagaming is actually a really good thing. You can start to plan, like, what would be the most exciting moment to reveal this thing that I know it's going to be revealed, because I'm going to reveal it. When would be, what's the best thing that can happen between your characters at this moment? Should I skip ahead? Should this be a flashback? Metagaming actually really helps narrative RPGs. And so no one has to stop thinking about certain things because they might metagame and ruin the game for themselves. There's no such thing as avoiding spoilers. The game isn't pre-planned. It's narrative.
And the way that you DM'd, the way that we played, Don't Rest Your Head, was partially as a horror game. That's definitely the way that the system mechanics seem to be. At no point did I doubt that the system mechanics were meant for a horror game. And provided they're for a horror game, I love the system mechanics. Provided for their dark fairy tale game, I don't think they fit. Because they focus too much on your character going mad and you having to bounce those things, and your character fighting or fleeing. That doesn't... Yeah. It's not very fairy tale-esque.
Yeah.
But in that... If you're playing a horror RPG, you need closed secrets. You need to keep the players from knowing how to react to the horror that's befalling them. In a horror RPG, unless you're going to leave the players completely unsatisfied at the end, they need to defeat the evil or seal the evil or run away from the evil at the end and have figured out how to, and figured out a little bit about what the evil is. Unless you're planning on having it being a recurring thing. And then even with a recurring thing, I'd prefer that you figure out how to defeat him that time, and he comes back stronger. You know?
Yeah.
But horror RPGs are a special case. In other cases, I don't think closed secrets usually lead to better play. I think, especially narrative RPGs, like Dungeon World, I could have my thief tell the other two players, yeah, I'm going to poison you with Golden Seal, so you have to trust me. And that doesn't take away from what's going to happen. Rather, the players are going to be anticipating that moment and building up to it.
That's another thing with open secrets is when you let them out. Like, when you tell them and metagame and stuff, their players are just like, oh, fuck, we gotta wait for this to happen now or whatever, right? And they're sort of like, they make up scenarios in their mind, you know? But like,
and then try to avoid them or play into them or playfully play around them and double innuendo type
of
ways.
It's like a manipulation trick, right? Believe it or not, actually, Dungeon World has a lot of closed secrets. And the closed secrets are what they call moves. When a DM uses a move on his list, he doesn't tell you what move he's using. He just uses it. So if he uses the move separate a player from the group, well, when you just fall through the floor, you don't really know what move he's using.
You just know that a player fell through the floor. You don't realize that the GM just used a move and that it has rules.
Well, Dungeon World is the game that you play. You play Dungeons and Dragons like you were 10 years old, so...
But generally, I don't think that closed secrets... Closed secret moves might work in a lot of narrative games, but they might just, you know, be a constraint on the DM. On the other hand, constraints can lead to, you know, more creativity.
Yeah. So, in most RPGs, what sort of social contracts... such as lines of veils, do you arrange with the players and character GM? For instance, this could be annoying pet peeves or things that places you don't really want to go.
I don't usually put any stretch constraints in other players. Generally, we don't have to talk about any such things. Lines and veils, none of us ever cross each other's borders.
Okay.
Obviously, when you're... As I was going to say, some of the players I've played with have had pet peeves. Like, Scott has a few pet peeves, like you can't sip drinks, you can't eat with your mouth open. Okay. That's okay. Other players will have some, like, we can't play D&D if you're going to munchkin it. Or, you can't rules lawyer.
Yeah,
I pretty much only start to talk to people. I don't set things beforehand, but if it comes to a problem, I talk to them. And I've only had to do that once. When someone was munchkining their character and no one else was, which leads to an obvious power gap, which makes it not fun for everyone else but him.
Okay.
So, and he didn't even realize he was munchkining. He just plays D&D a lot, and he knew exactly the type of build he wanted to make.
Gotcha.
You know, well, didn't realize with just doing his usual stuff, whatever, you know. I mean, sometimes someone will say, I think you should play someone who's more towards yourself, because I don't think you'll play that role well. Sometimes I agree with them, sometimes I go along with it anyway. Sometimes I've been told I'm power gaming. I have pretty regular RPG groups, and those RPG groups that, you know, cross any kind of, that would require me to make any kind of social contracts are just not fun in general, so I just don't attend them again. Because I already have, you know, a couple of regular RPG groups now. Yeah, I think there's a couple of characters I've played over the wilds who, have been too edgy, and I would always have to say, I'm just saying this because of my character. And eventually you would eventually realize that's not fun, no matter how interesting this character makes the game. One of them ended up becoming the main villain and being the main motivation for the characters. So he was really fucking interesting, but he wasn't fun for me to play. Just for everyone else to hate. You know what I mean? Because every time I said something, that's the character.
Like social contract isn't really like anything that's like, for instance, Baki Nai, the person was like no reference to like Monty Python.
I can totally understand that.
Right?
I can totally understand that. And now that you say that, one of the rules of RPG group that I went to once was no singing. No, we mean no singing. It was a fun group.
What book, TV show, or film is the most inspiring for role-playing?
Oh.
Or what feature or something?
Well, I rarely watch movies, so that's that. It's difficult to say. I don't really think about things I've read or things I've watched or anything when I roleplay. If I had to say about the depths of characters and the way characters are built, when I think about how characters are built, I usually think about Ursula K. Le Guin's writing, because usually in her books and her short stories, at no point does she say he was an X person who did X. She always kind of just lets you see that for yourself. If she describes a character, that's because he's not going to be like that for the rest of the book. Like, or he's going to change, or because this is just a short scene when he's a teenager and now you're going to watch him become a full-fledged wizard. Earthsea did that several times where she described Sparrowhawk, and then he was never like that ever again. And that was on purpose, and that was, if you examine it, if you study it, it's clear. If you don't examine it, you don't care because you don't notice these type of things. You know? So if I want a character to be quick or genius, I don't show a scene being with him being an obvious genius. It builds from a lot of small facts, and then when such a scene appears, it's because the scene is natural, not because I want to shoehorn in a detail. You know what I mean?
So it's more or less you like to build characters based off of
the way that Ursula K. Le Guin builds characters in her books and novels.
Cool. Do you have any role playing habits or superstitions?
No superstitions I actually believe in.
Like your dice?
Yeah, but I will actually keep my dice up on the 6 side, or the 20 side, or the 12 side, whatever. I will.
Even on the orange head?
Yeah. Yeah. there's certain ways I will roll the dice. If I have too many dice, I will split them up according to certain protocols. And, you know, you make a big thing out of criticals or really big misses or stuff is normal. What was the other half of the question besides
superstitions
or habits? As for habits, you know, there's certain characters that I always like to play. Some of them are somewhat like me. Some of them are just the things that people imagine I am like, which can be more fun to play. Carpe Lodosi was one of them. He was supposed to be a character that people think I'm like, and they did. And by the time it ended, they were like, that character's nothing like you, now that we actually know you. And that's great fun, because you can play off people's ideas of you, and do horrible, horrible things with your character, and people kind of, you know, scratch their head. And, you know, in Shadowrun, I will always play Technomancer. I fucking love the hacking system in Shadowrun. I just love the entire idea of cyberspace. In D&D, I always play Rogue, etc., etc. Superstitions, I think it's a dice superstitions, and that's it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you always have to have a proper pouch for them.
Mm-hmm.
It's important. My first one was just a patch of silk sewed up with some fancy buttons on the front. But it made my dice happy.
Good. For role-playing games, does system matter?
Does system matter? Abso-fucking-lutely, and not at all. When we only had D&D, you know, between me and my brothers, we would try sessions where we would modify the D&D system so that we could be X-Men, or so that we could be X, or so that we could be Y, or so that we could be gods. And that was really fun. And it worked, even though we were fucking with the system, and if you have a good GM and good players, the system might not matter at all. On the other hand, there's a few key things that I think the system needs. There needs to be a system setting agreement. If I'm in Ponyville, and I'm playing with a D&D-based system, I don't think that'll work very well. Because that's supposed to be about learning friendship, not killing monsters in the Everfree Forest. Pinkie Pie never goes out and says, I'm going to kill me a cockatrice today. No, she zips around and be hyper and eats cake. You know, so there needs to be kind of system-setting agreement. If it's a gaming system, if it's very heavy on rules, either in simulation or in the board games type of rules, it needs to be balanced. In simulation, you can get away with that a bit more because not all things are equal in real life or in all worlds. In some worlds, everyone in Magic is all-powerful because Magic is, in fact, all-powerful. But there should be some sort of balance so that the players are encouraged to play in a way that's good for the setting. Or just good in general. There's some systems that I don't think would ever be fun no matter what setting they're teamed with. Most of the time, I'd rather play systems that's already done for me rather than adapting a lot of stuff that I would likely do the same way. Because if I end up not liking the system, it's a lot less trouble to, you know, manipulate this one small thing than to you know, create a whole new system from D&D. Like, I mean, you look at Pathfinder, they changed a fuck lot of that, but it still plays exactly like D&D. They changed the core, but not enough for it to actually matter, you know? And they put a lot of work into that. And I sometimes use Pathfinder interchangeably with 3.5 because they feel exactly the same to play in the DM, you know? I don't know if you agree with that.
No, I do. There's an actual... there's a sheet you can get... Well, actually, you can get this mini booklet from Paizo. And it is the D&D conversion booklet. You go through the booklet and you convert anything for the D&D 3.5 world into...
That was also the intention, but... I thought for something that has its own complete rulebooks and everything, it should feel different. But in general, I don't like Pathfinder or D&D anymore because I've played much better RPGs.
Well,
I can still see them have to give place, but I don't think I would ever play a long session with them again. I might not ever finish that Goblin session I have, even though I put so much work into that.
How much of the storytelling should be GM and players relatively to each other?
Well, that completely depends on the RPG. You're playing Shadowrun, you're playing D&D.
But for yourself?
For myself, where would I like it to be in an RPG?
Yeah. If you're gonna...
I love the Fiasco model, where everyone is equally contributing, and there is, in fact, no DM. The stories become absolutely amazing. And I don't know why I bleeped myself out there, since I said fuck everywhere else. But, on the other hand, you know, we were playing Fiasco week after week after week, and we got burned out. We weren't making stories any less awesome, but there was something that was lost, you know, in awesome stories every week. I would be exhausted at the end, but I wouldn't, at every point, I would just be immediately coming out with something. What I was like, we got stuck there.
The question was, how much of storytelling should the GM players have relevant to each other?
So it depends on the RPG that I'm playing. Sometimes I'm going in for Fiasco, and I want to tell an awesome story with friends. But I get burned out on that. And sometimes I want to be telling an awesome story to people and have them shape the story. Sometimes I want to go in it completely free fly, but pretend I'm shaping it while they're actually doing all the work. I did that a lot with anime RPG.
So you're going to give it a rating, like out of 100 points. Who's the most, I guess, important role in games? Would it be the players or the system? Like, if you were going to guess...
Well, the players and GM together collectively have 60 points. So the system, by process of elimination, has 4. The system, by process of elimination, has 40 combined with this setting. I would kind of say maybe 10 points to the system itself, 10 points to the setting itself, and then 20 points to how well the system and settings were, setting works together.
So it's all 40, though, for the system.
Yeah, it's 40 for that collectively.
We'll assume that the system includes the setting, not just a rules...
Yeah, I just want to be clear. And then for the player's GM, it would depend entirely on the RPG. In D&D, it's 50 GM, 10 player. In Fiasco, everyone's a player. So that's a stupid example. In Don't Rest Your Head, I would think it's kind of like 40 towards the player, 20 towards the GM. Because the players, they keep the tone, or they set the tone. They develop what is actually going to happen. The GM kind of... Maybe that'd be more like 30-30, because the players have to be personally involved in Don't Rest Your Head. So they're very important. But they can't do that without the GM. The GM can't tell a story without them. It's,
but what you're saying, basically, is almost half is the system by itself without the GM and the player. So the system is important.
A good system is important. But... Even more important than the system is just the way it works with all its different components. I don't care if it's a simple system. A really simple system that works really well with the setting does wonders. You know? And sometimes, like with D&D, more often than not, I never used any official setting just because there's already kind of an implied setting with the system. There's only one setting that really works well with the system. Like the mechanics part of the system, you know what I mean? And... if you deviate from that, it you're not playing D&D anymore. You're modifying the system to do something else, right?
Yeah.
I think you should modify Dungeons & Dragons as you see fit, because the setting you want to play will probably not be one of the settings that's there. So the way you should modify D&D is to encourage the setting that you like. And, you know, the setting is more than just, here's some place names, here's some whatever. It's also, you know, the tone of the atmosphere and all that stuff. So horror RPG has a vastly different setting than D&D, even if they both take place in the same universe, like, I don't know, Eberroth or something. Or, Angwe. Birthright. I mean, I can definitely see some awesome horror RPGs coming out of Angwe.
Yeah, but not in the system.
But not in D&D system. So, on the other hand, a modified D&D system could work for a horror RPG, but then you're relying on your GM and your players to be good players and a good GM, you know? So, but it's definitely not the system that makes the RPG. It's the other people you're playing with. So they definitely have the greater share of it wherever it lies.
Cool. Well, that's probably one question. Yeah, like what you do with, or how did you start up the Mun Tabletop group?
Okay. The Mun Tabletop, the Mun Tabletop Games Club was not originally my idea.
Okay.
It was the idea of several people I was hanging out with at the time, the main one being Jessica Hickey. So I got four people to sign off with me and her, and I put them in through Munsu. And someone actually had to go say to the meeting, like, wait, why aren't we bringing up this club? And realized that they had missed the goddamn paperwork four times in a row. You know, just misplaced it. Because Munsu was kind of not as organized as they are now. They're still not very organized. Cough, cough. And then by the time it finally started, those four people were busy with other things for the times we had planned. And, you know, one of those four people was Jessica Hickey. So I think she attended maybe three of the meetings that we had. And then she just never had time at the same time as us. And so I had a few people, you know, join the club because they heard about it over Facebook or through the posters we put up or through word of mouth. Like, the greatest recruitment method I've had has always been telling people about it. Here's where we meet. Here's where you can contact us. And at first we only had five people, and they met every week, and then that grew to nine people. And we were at nine people for such a long time, we actually made a card game that requires exactly nine people. It's called Plan 9. You might have seen it on Ron's TimeCave.net website. Okay. He might not have it up anymore, I don't remember. And we just kind of slowly grew from there. But we never exploded like we expected to. Like, there was so much interest in board gaming. But so little people would actually show up to meetings. And
what do you think that was?
Hmm?
What do you think that was?
I think that's just a general apathy in the area. People are just generally apathetic. They say, yeah, I want a board game, but then they never come. Yeah, I want to LARP, but no one comes, you know? We actually had 40, 50 people interested in the LARP. Myself and one other organizer, and none of the other organizers and no one else showed up to the LARP meetings we held. For the interview, I also tried to start a LARP in St. John's based on Epic on the Rock. So that was kind of slow growing, and we went through a lot of, you know, growing pains. And there was a lot of... There were actually people who were trying to shut down the Mun TGC at one time. Still never found out who they were. I kind of made it a point not to try and figure out who it was, because I thought it might be people who were part of the club. Now I no longer think that. But there was stuff like the police were getting prank calls every week, like, oh, there was some baker outside of the Extreme Pita location in the UC who was, you know, using a cane and kind of balding. And, oh, that, you know, that can only be Sean, one of our members. Another time, you know, they got these prank calls for about a month and a half before they called me and told me, we're not going to pay attention to these anymore. Because none of them were ever true, none of them were ever verifiable, but someone's actually trying to do that. There were small things inside the club that would suddenly get blown up into big controversies. Like, at one point, I let the executive name themselves. And so we named ourselves silly things. Like, I was the benevolent dictator. Someone else was the minister of propaganda. And I think the person we had set in charge of purchasing or the treasury had named themselves something like director in charge of purchasing nuclear weaponry. Or weapons of mass destruction. And obviously, that's not serious. Obviously, you know, not even the most Puritan Catholic is going to look at that and say these people are evil and they're planning to subvert our youth. Because, you know, it's just so far over the top. The Board Games Club is not buying weapons of mass destruction. But that became a huge controversy. And people outside the club heard about it who had no interest in board gaming and were chastising me. And I was like, what? So, but that's over. And, And since then, the club has just kind of been stagnant, not really growing, not really
You know, I've tried to do a new thing every semester. So we've had, you know, RPG night. We had a games workshop. We had, we tried one time to have long board games night because, you know, short board games tend to be played at the club. And then people are doing short board games, they start another one. And then more people trickle in, and there's none, you know, they don't want to be doing nothing, so they start a short board game. And there's never enough people who are interested in a long board game to get one started, so I figured special night. But then no one was interested. So everyone was clamoring about not being able to play Talisman or Agricola, or, because we had a few slow people at the time, so Agricola actually took 4 hours. Or Agricola or Arkham Horror. But then no one signed up to actually, you know, play the games when we planned to play them. Because time and constraints, or because they weren't that interested in playing Talisman except when someone brought it up, you know? Or they all wanted to play different games. So Pete wanted to play Talisman, but he didn't want to play any of the other long games we had. And, you know, yeah, other stuff like that. So there's a lot of things I'm trying to do, or a lot of ideas I'm throwing out there that are separate from you guys and what I've told you guys. Like, I think I might have told you I'm trying to start up a, you know, more general video gaming club than... Oh. I'm trying to find people who are interested in doing that and trying to encourage them to make a club. I'm not interested in running it or even joining it, but I'd like to provide other people with the opportunity to make one. Yeah. I think it was like the Mud TGC wasn't only, you know, just the weekly meetings. That club, like I had three ideas in mind when I started. One was that, you know, we would provide the weekly meetings to provide the time and space for people who didn't know other gamers to come and meet some of them.
Yeah, I'm surprised actually it didn't blow up more than that.
Yeah, like, I mean, if we just had four people coming every week and a group of four people leaving to form their own club or their own group of friends every week, that would have been awesome.
Yeah.
So one was to make the weekly time and space for people to just drop in. The second was just to provide the resources necessary for people to come in and do their own events or do their own clubs. So if someone ever wanted to make their own event, like a charity event or something, I would totally book the room for them. I would help them organize. No one ever took advantage of that. To the third reason why I wanted to create the Games Club was that we provide a good playtesting environment and provide a good design environment for people who want to create their own games. And that's worked beautifully. I don't know of any other club which has created as many games as we have. We attract a lot of people who are into games design. So, I mean, Ron has a dozen games under his belt. Peter has Chaos Dungeons and a couple of other stuff. Chaos Dungeons is the big one he keeps coming back to. You know, I've made a couple of games. We had a guy, Peter, who is busy on Wednesdays with class this semester, who has made a couple of games and RPGs before. We had John, who is a full-time engineering student, so he never has time to think about us anymore. I tried to hand off the presidency to him because he thought he could handle, you know, that and a full-time engineering student. I didn't expect him to succeed, and he didn't. He just broke off contact in the middle of October and came back in November and said, "I'm really sorry, guys. I was swamped with assignments and midterms." And I was already there for a month, you know, expecting him at any moment to say, to not be able to show up or not to... So, yeah. Because I know the Games Club will survive forever without me. Like, I think Peter even said on Facebook recently, "We will continue to meet on Wednesday at 5 p.m. until the end of time." That is just our date now. We tried to change that at first to best reflect everyone's schedules. It just always ended up being Wednesday, because the people who are part of Games Club are people who are free on Wednesday. Oh, I haven't even mentioned the St. John's Games Club, which, the St. John's Games Club, I started going to that after we had decided to make them on TGC, but before we had officially formed, because of the paperwork. And right from the beginning, we had people in both the St. John's Games Club and in them on TGC. That's actually where I got Peter from. Because I mentioned that one of our guys was making a Final Fantasy card game, and Peter's like, "That's wrong. I do it wrong. I shall go to your club." And Peter's been a member ever since, with a slight break in between. Yeah, the St. John's Games Club. That's not your St. John's Games Club.
I want to thank Charles for letting me interview him and waste all of his time.
And make all that admin work.
And make it all the, like, fuck you. I'm just going to turn this off now.